tonight on Arena. We hear from country music royalty with Roseanne Cash, and we speak with Mircea Cărtărescu, winner of this year's Dublin Literary Award. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on the live stream rte.ie/arena. Tonight on our film reviews, stories of revenge, ransom and the unbearable weight of massive musical talent and mothers who muscle in the process as well. In Furiosa, Anya Taylor-Joy gives new life to George Miller's Dark Angel in this prequel to his beloved Antipodean apocalypse saga. Ransom 79 tells a tale of dogged journalism under the most difficult of circumstances. And in Piano Dreams, we meet a group of gifted Chinese children with ambitions to become professional classic musicians, according to their mothers. Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington have been to the movies with me in studio this evening. And we'll start with Furiosa, a Mad Max saga set in the post-apocalyptic, petrol-obsessed future. This new story is a prequel to the phenomenally successful Fury Road, which took cinemas by storm in 2015. So we're going back further, giving us the origin story to Furiosa, an angry woman with one thing on her mind, and that is revenge. So, Ruth, set up the plot for us here. Who is Furiosa? We're meeting her very young. We've met her before, a little older. Yeah. And why is she annoyed?
She's furious. And she's got a teddy bear in her sights. She is furious because she's doing a little, you know, fruit picking in the basically Garden of Eden, where she and her mother and various and the many other mothers live, when she decides to go and mess with one of the bikers' fuel tanks. She's kidnapped by the bikers. Her mother comes to rescue her, and it's not giving anything away to say that mum comes to a very nasty end, but just think Joan of Arc. And okay. So this is the first of many torture sequences that you're going to enjoy if you do go to see this movie, because she then has to get her revenge on her mother. She's kidnapped variously by many people, chief amongst them Dementus, which is, of course, Chris Hemsworth. And you know, she kind of moves between all these various bad guys.
All right.
She dresses up. She disguises herself as a boy, and then she's picked up by all time good guy Praetorian Jack, played by Tom Burke, and he turns her into the warrior that she's going to be actually later on
when she grows into
the last film,
Charlize Theron.
Yeah,
in the last film.
Yeah.
So we have two versions, or two actors playing Furiosa here.
Yes.
Anya Taylor-Joy for the most part, the kind of the bulk of the film, and a young actor called Alia Brown at the beginning.
Yeah,
Anya Taylor-Joy has this phenomenal presence. She has to, she barely has to speak to command the screen, doesn't she?
She needs it, because one of the things people missed about George Miller's early Mad Max films, because they looked so kind of, everybody's giving out about him and they look kind of B-movie-ish, was how good a storyteller he was and how little dialogue he uses, very deliberately. And in this, and for various reasons, because she's holding her tongue, because she doesn't want to give away the place of plenty, whatever they call it,
the green place of many mothers.
The green place of many mothers. No wonder I couldn't remember it. So she doesn't speak for a while, but then she deliberately doesn't speak. She's very laconic in the tradition, as George Miller said himself. I was talking to him at the weekend, of Clint Eastwood and John Wayne. But she does it really well, and she grows into. There's a brilliant action sequence in the middle. One of the best action sequences.
Oh, the action sequences are fantastic.
Mm. Yeah, and it's aboard this huge 16-wheel rig, this kind of chrome thing, and it becomes a kind of stage onto which all these lunatic bikers and abseiling bikers and everything come and go. Mm. And that's when she reveals her talents for the first time, and it's a brilliant, brilliant sequence. Yeah.
So she's out to get Dr. Dementus, played by Chris Hemsworth.
And then she'll be out to get Immortan Joe after that, the other nasty fella.
Yeah. So the nasties are going to have to meet her again, and she's going to want to remind them that they know her from the past. As we will hear in this clip, Anya Taylor-Joy as Furiosa, facing off against the said Dr. Dementus, played by Chris Hemsworth.
Remember me?
You fabulous thing. You crawled out of a pitiless grave deeper than hell. Only one thing's gonna do that for you. Not hope. Hate.
No shame in hate. It's one of the great forces of nature.
That wasn't hope, that was instinct.
There you go, Anya Taylor-Joy. saying two words, and somehow, even though it's purely audio, she commanded that 26-second clip.
Yeah, she did, and up against Chris Hemsworth, who is wildly hamming it up intentionally. He wears this, I thought it was so he wouldn't look like Thor, but apparently it was something to do with that, but he wears this, he has his bad teeth and different colour eyes and this prosthetic nose that makes him look like Peter O'Toole before the nose job, basically. And he it's not like anything you've seen him do before, and it's kind of, there's an absurdity to it because there's an absurdity to this character, you know, shaking his fist at the sky in a desert, but it works up against her because she says nothing and he seems the weaker because he talks all the time.
And can we see her, can we see the Anya Taylor-Joy Furiosa becoming the Charlize Theron Furiosa of
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's a different actor, obviously, and she's perhaps not as sort of physically robust as Charlize Theron. But she has this kind of real ethereal presence in the film. She's almost kind of there and not there. And so she is kind of ghost-like within the story, which is sort of part of what makes it. Because
he uses her eyes. Sorry,
her eyes very well.
She's
got kind of triangular face.
Yeah, she does. Yeah.
And she looks strange. And the men are so macho, absurdly macho, you know, in an totally exaggerated way. So then you have this kind of tiny, kind of very petite actor. And so she has to hold her own in a very different way in the film, but she's really got a place in it.
Yeah, and there are bad guys, but there are good guys. Praetorian Jack, played by Tom Burke, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's basically the driver of this huge rig, and he kind of takes her under a wing, which is a risk because the wasteland is full of these kind of feral people who cut your throat.
Yeah, and when you meet them, you don't know which side they're on.
You don't. Yeah.
Let's have a listen to the moment. This is when Tom Burke's Praetorian Jack, I think this is when they meet, isn't it? Yeah. And she points a gun at him.
Where did you think you were going?
If you survive everything we take on together, you'll have all the skills you need to get wherever you want to go. Keep it. You'll need it. This place, at the end of your map of secrets, I want to help you find it.
Oh, you trust him, Tom.
Oh, he's good. Yeah. He's the good guy.
I'm doing a very fine Australian accent. Is it necessary?
Well, I mean, the film is notionally set in Australia. It's the wasteland. But since there is a kind of undercurrent of Australianness, this film has got nothing to do with Mad Max, right? So if you're going to tie it into previous Mad Max,
and also if you weren't Australian, geez, you wouldn't hang around there. It's an awful bloody place.
We won't say anything further about the Australian landscape. Okay.
I mean, in the film, I don't mean the actual Australian.
Absolutely. Do we? Is this worth adding to the Mad Max kind of franchise? Should we go and see it?
Absolutely. I think that basically special effects and filmmaking techniques have caught up with George Miller's imagination. You saw that in Fury Road. And this, he actually wrote the screenplay for this before Fury Road, so they'd know what they were doing in Fury Road. And I think it continues on beautifully from the action sequences are marvellous, and it's a real IMAX treat, I think.
Okay. Oh, you've got to go to the IMAX. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Four.
What are you saying?
Yeah, I'm a four too. I mean, I don't think it's not quite as great as Fury Road, which would be a five. So come down one, it's a four. It's still great entertainment.
All right. Great entertainment is the
pure
view
cinema.
There. Pure cinema. They definitely can put both of those on the poster. Furiosa, the film we've been speaking about there. Let's move on then to Ransom 79, telling the story, of course, of the great Charlie Bird and his determination to break one final story before his life was cut short by motor neuron disease. We spoke with Colin Murphy, who was the reporter who worked with him, and Colin Quinn, who was the director of the film. We had them on the programme earlier in the week. This is phenomenal that despite the fact that he was dying and knew that he was dying, the investigative journalist that was Charlie Bird was out there with every ounce of energy he could muster up breaking this story, Ruth.
I actually thought this was a fantastic documentary. And I mean, the story, I know you went through at an arena the other day. So it's, there's this ransom note is delivered to the government. It's called...
In 1979.
It's called Ransom 79 because it's 1979. And they're holding the government to £5 million, as it was then. And if the government doesn't cough up £5 million, they will introduce foot and mouth into the country. Charlie Bird gets the story before the M&D diagnosis. But then what the film is about is he decides, although he is, you know, ill and you know, getting progressively worse, that this is what will keep him going. So he doesn't want to sit. He doesn't want a wheelchair. He's very determined to have a life before death. And so what keeps him going is this one last investigation. And it's the craziest investigation.
I know, you know, guys, as I said to both Colin Murphy and Colin Quinn the other night, it does sound like some fictional crime caper that has been thrown in front of us.
Yeah.
But this was real.
It does. And I wasn't expecting the actual case to be as interesting. And it's fascinating to begin with to watch Charlie at work with Colin, and how he works is amazing. But the story, and they managed to get to a lot of people.
Yeah,
there's this whole thing about this car. It was Sarah Arrow, wasn't it? This car hanging around on off O'Connell Street that was supposed to be the switch for money. And civil servants actually very skillfully kicked the can down the road all the time.
Like,
and they even talked to the very laconic Garda driver who drove this car on this remarkable sort of slow chase down to Wexford and back up to Dublin. You couldn't make it up, but those were the times.
And not only that, what I find most extraordinary about this is you kind of think the people that were prepared to speak to Charlie Bird, he gets Jerry Collins, the former Minister of Justice, to speak to him. And these fellas have sat on this story for, you know, half a century.
You have to ask yourself.
And his IRA contact as well.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. And the guard, and the retired guard who now is happy
to tell the story. And the guy who was in the Department of Agriculture where the ransom note came to, who said, well, I wouldn't be talking about this, only you're asking me. I would have quite
Also the sort of wonderful, almost sort of Sherlock Holmes or John le Carré touch of that they communicated through the personal as in the Irish Times.
These
polite notes that got ever more urgent as nothing was happening.
He also eventually got, and I'd love to know how they got Ray McSherry, the Minister for Agriculture.
That surprised me.
Because he was the person, or the minister, who sat on this story. But listen to how he answers. First of all, you hear Charlie Bird, and of course we hear his voice through the wonderful technology that allowed him
the voice bank. Amazing.
A phenomenal piece of machinery. And here he is posing a question to Ray McSherry.
Bertie Ahern knew nothing about this. Jerry Collins, nothing about us. Did you bring it to Cabinet? Did you discuss with your colleagues?
The item wasn't discussed at Cabinet by me or by any other minister, nor did I inform the Taoiseach, because we kept it within the closed circle as close as was possible and necessary to ensure that we could manage it ourselves. Because in these sort of circumstances, you learn to keep control of things you know that don't need to be told to others. Even as serious as this was, the less people that knew about it, the better.
Keep control of things.
Think
you
that,
know.
Don't they? The less people
But but it's a phenomenal. That's Ray McSherry speaking to Charlie Bird, and Charlie Bird via the voice bank, of course, technology, as part of this film, Ransom 79. Yes, we get that investigative journalism thing, but very cleverly, we also get the story of the progression of the illness. Mm. And this had the chance of, I thought, of derailing the film, but they just balanced it perfectly between the two stories, Ruth.
Yeah, I mean, it was extraordinarily moving. And it's really, it hinges on the really close, trusting relationship between Colin Murphy and Charlie Bird. And because Murphy's asking these very, you know, straight questions. How do you feel? How do you feel? Do you really want to do this? You know, wouldn't you prefer to stay at home? No, I wouldn't. How do you feel about dying? I mean, he asks him the questions that we would have maybe not been so bold as to ask if it had been us. And I think, and you're always, you know, you're tracing, you just notice very, you know, he can't do this, he can't do this. Yeah. And then his sort of fury, he suddenly, like, he gets fed up with everything. He starts scribbling notes on a piece of paper, you know, the questions that he wants them to ask. Had it just been about one of the stories, or just about the other story, it would have been a much lesser documentary.
Yeah. No, as you say, the balance is very good.
The way they interweave them, it's
and
so
also
good.
When you think about it from Colm Quinn's point of view, the director, it was all, and he was saying this, was it was all stop start. Like, I mean, they, you know, they didn't know when they could film, when they couldn't, and you don't get the sense of that.
Not
it flows
at all.
In a very nice way.
Yeah, and he seemed, and Charlie Bird seems in the full of his health. You know, yes, you can see some deterioration.
Yeah.
Beautifully handled. Stars from you on this one, Paul?
A 4, I really like this documentary.
4, and Ruth?
At 4.5, I just thought it was great.
Yeah, really good stuff indeed. Now, I've been waiting all night for this. There are 9 million bicycles we know in Beijing. There are 40 million piano students in China. That is the basis of Piano Dreams, the Gary Lennon.
It's a lot of pianos, Sean.
Yeah, it's a lot of pianos. Yeah. But not 40 million in China, so you'd have
I
to
suppose,
work.
That's
you'd
true.
Have to work out. You'd have
that's
to
true.
Work
per
out.
Per head of the population, yeah, maybe not so much.
However, this is all about 3 young kids. It's a documentary about a very young kid, an 8-year-old, a 16 or 17-year-old girl, and an older boy, maybe 18, 19, who are phenomenal pianists, it has to be said, Ruth. Mm.
Oh, they're phenomenal. And they are phenomenal because, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction, they have phenomenal mothers who are pushing them the whole way, particularly the 2 older kids.
Yeah.
Because the younger mother is a bit cooler and she's saying, I don't mind if he doesn't make it.
Yeah, but she's much more.
Yeah, she goes to the gym and she does other stuff.
Yeah.
Like, but the other, they've given up. The whole families have
Doesn't
given up.
Doesn't
the
kid want to be like an airline
pilot?
Yeah,
maybe I'll be an airline
during the day
pilot,
and a concert pianist at night.
Yeah, he's a real showman too, that kid. But and I felt most actually for the young girl. Ying, who she's just sort of, you know, preteen. She's at a really susceptible age. She's been so pushed, and she's looking at failure in the face. And
there's no plan B for
someone. She's the one who gives us the line.
And you know, in the case of that family, isn't it? Her granny was very ill. Her father's mother was very ill at the time.
That's right.
Still, they went to the competition.
They still went to the competition. And there's this whole thing about, you know, they actually, you know, they come from these really remote places. And one of the mothers, for 5 years, she drove that. She put that child. She and her child traveled by overnight train to Shanghai. They then, the child played piano, had a piano lesson. They got on the next overnight train, 5 hours
back home
every single weekend for 5 years. Unbelievable.
Do you want to hear what an 8-year-old pianist sounds like? Now, those of you who have listened to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star several times over on the piano at home from your 7 or 8-year-old, have a listen to this 8-year-old.
The thing, there's this thing.
That's an 8-year-old Chinese boy as part of this.
It's kind of terrifying, isn't it? There's this accusation that's often levelled at Chinese pianists that there's a kind of automatic quality to it and so on. And I mean, sometimes I think that's fair and sometimes it's unfair, but
particularly in the case of, well, he, you know,
he's too young.
He's very young.
But too young for nuance,
But that's fair and that's fine.
He was technically going along a great pelt, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And the older boy, I'm pretty certain for the most part through the film, plays Chopin. And Chopin will be, this is where it's all about expression.
Yeah.
In fact, it's not about necessarily
emotion,
about flashy kind of technique and speed. It's about something else. However, what about the parental desire for the success of the children here?
Well, as Ruth mentioned earlier, the thing is, I mean, there's, you know, there's, what would you say, 30 million or whatever, but I mean, like, obviously the failure rate is massive, and that's what makes me worry about people, parents concentrating children on things that might not work out for them at such an early stage, because it must be devastating for them. And what do they do then? Go and work in a factory?
I mean, also their kind of culture that failure is just not acceptable.
It's not good.
As well.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different culture. I mean, the father actually in it, who's got diabetes, he does explain, he's one of the few people who actually sort of explains to camera how different Chinese culture is.
And it is.
And it really is. And I mean, that's one of the things I kind of valued about this film is because we only really hear about China through news headlines, yeah. and they're always negative. And we don't really know about what
goes on. That was the interesting thing about it.
Yeah,
this middle-class China.
That's right. Yeah. I was kind of interested in their homes and their families.
And they were ordinary people.
They were a little bit privileged.
Yeah, they probably were upper middle class. They just wouldn't have had the facility for the music lessons and the Steinway pianos that they all had at home. But, you know, these were ordinary people in many ways, too.
Yeah, it was a fascinating glimpse Absolutely, into that. Absolutely, yeah. I really valued it for
and
that.
And one person says, I think, towards the end, that they think that there's going to be a piano, and it's going to be like a computer, be a piano in every home in China.
Like a computer.
That is a lot of pianos.
That's a lot.
That is an awful lot of pianos.
Yeah.
At the end of this, were you wiser about this whole Asian phenomenon of the piano player?
Well, I think I was more... I think I was probably wiser about the kind of what sets it up.
Yeah.
And also what's acceptable, you know, in terms of teaching, because I mean one of the kind of characters in it is also the young child's piano teacher who's brutal to him.
Yeah.
That would be not
acceptable.
He wants to give him a smack, but grandfather's there. And he really gives out. This child's only
Which
eight.
Makes you wonder what happens when grandfather isn't there.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And the cameras aren't there.
Yeah, and the cameras aren't there. But then you see them kind of skipping down the street and they're really bonded.
Yeah.
But it's an insight into a way of teaching and a way of bringing up children that isn't, it isn't our way. It doesn't make it wrong.
Gary Lennon has done an amazing job just to tell this story across the three.
He has, and he's tried to avoid the kind of cliches as well. I think
Stars from you on this one, first, Ruth.
I give it 4. I was very engaged by it.
You've had a good week at the cinema.
I have.
Similarly, 4. Yeah.
All right. That is Piano Dreams from Paul Whittington and Ruth Barton. And Piano Dreams will be in selected cinemas, while Furiosa and Ransom 79, I beg your pardon, Ransom 79 goes on release tomorrow. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. American singer-songwriter and author Roseanne Cash is the eldest daughter of country musician Johnny Cash and his first wife Vivian Cash. Beginning her own musical career in the late 1970s, Roseanne has received 16 Grammy nominations and has had 4 wins. She will be at the National Concert Hall next month with her husband John Leventhal and songwriter Aoife O'Donovan to mark the launch of the Musician Treatment Fund in Ireland. The fund provides vital orthopaedic care for musicians' shoulders, elbows and hands and has so far delivered over $2.7 million in care through its Physicians for Musicians network. Delighted to be joined on the line by Roseanne Cash this evening, who's speaking to us from New York. This fund of yours, or this Musicians Treatment Fund that you're so invested in, Roseanne, you set it up with your husband John. What was the point, or what was the starting point for all of that?
Well, hello, it's nice to speak to you.
You too.
It was actually Dr. Alton Barron who founded the Musician Treatment Foundation. And he's a surgeon. So he, you know, found that a lot of musicians who had repetitive injuries from playing instruments or other injuries that directly affected their ability to make a living making music, that they couldn't afford it, that they didn't have health insurance or they didn't have enough health insurance to cover a surgery and time off from work. So he started doing this out of the goodness of his heart. And our friend Elvis Costello is a big supporter of his and asked my husband John and I if we would perform at one of the benefits in Austin, Texas. And we did, and we kind of fell in love with Alton. He's just a big-hearted visionary. And so we've been supporting him since. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time we've come to Ireland to do this. So I love Aoife O'Donovan. She's a person, so to get to perform with her is just icing on the cake.
Yeah, I wondered in the case of Aoife O'Donovan, given the name, that there must be some kind of Irish connection there.
I would think so.
And listen, the other thing I wondered about, the fact that you're doing this benefit now in the National Concert Hall in Ireland to launch this Musicians Treatment Foundation here in this country, or certainly to get us involved in it, will whatever funds you raise here, can it benefit musicians in Ireland as well as elsewhere?
Oh, gosh, yes. I would certainly hope so. I mean, you do have better health insurance than we do in America, but I imagine some people still need help.
Absolutely. Well, as you know, I mean, for many artists and musicians, it is a difficult thing to make the pennies all add up. So I'm sure that the fact that this might help them would be very welcome indeed. I was thinking about your own. Now, I know this isn't directly related to the fund or indeed to you getting any help from it. The brain injury or surgery that you had some time back, your own brush with health and the role that music played in your recovery is very interesting.
Yeah. So I had brain surgery in 2007 for a kind of rare anomaly in my brain, and it took a long time to recover. And you're right. I got out my my piano books from early childhood and retaught myself all of those pieces in the books. And listening to classical music helped quite a lot. I found myself unable to tolerate lyrics for quite some time. So listening to classical was great for me. And, you know, I absolutely believe music can heal the brain. And in fact, the diva, the wonderful singer Renee Fleming, just edited a book called Music and Mind about that very thing. And I contributed an essay to this book. It's fascinating.
The other aspect of this is, I suppose, I know you were saying in that particular recovery period, you were avoiding lyrics, but much of the music that you sing on stage obviously has, has lyrics in it. And one of the things, of course, that I think your father, Johnny Cash, has said this, and you have said it too, when you go on stage, you do ask yourself questions, or you put the questions out there on the stage as you perform. Talk to me a little bit about that emotional journey, because there must be healing in that, to perform maybe emotionally difficult material or that touches you in an emotional way.
And, you know, it depends on the day, the night, the audience, the venue, how tired you are, what you need, what you're taking to the stage. It's really, I mean, I saw my dad do this where he took the best parts of himself to the spotlight. And there was, between him and the audience, this chemical exchange of energy. There was true depth of feeling and healing. And I have found that in my own life as well. And it's something about the community with the audience. It's not just about going to be seen and heard. It's about that sense of community and exchange. And, you know, Bob Dylan said a great thing. He said, the audience doesn't come to feel your feelings. They come to feel their own feelings. So, you know, if you serve as a spark for that, that's a great service.
And I guess, but there is ultimately that communication between audience and performer, which is what makes live music so special. It's only for the people who are there in the hall on that particular night at that particular moment.
That's right. I mean, of course, bits and pieces get up to YouTube, but there's nothing like being... It's like a monk sand painting that's kind of destroyed once it's over. It was those 2 hours. That was it. And that's part of the great beauty of it.
I can only imagine what the emotional temperature can have been like in 2003 when you recorded September When It Comes with your father. And this is a song written for the two of you by your husband. I mean, that's a song that is incredibly potent in terms of familial relationships.
Well, John wrote the music. My husband wrote the music. I had written the lyrics and he found them laying around. I'm not very organized sometimes. And he picked them up and he said, "What's this?" And I said, "It's some lyrics I wrote." And he wrote the music to it, and this beautiful, mournful melody. And it was called September When It Comes, as you said. And then my dad ended up dying in September. And Vice President Al Gore spoke at my dad's memorial. And he said, "It's September." Yeah. And, you know, we were all in tears. Yeah. It was a beautiful moment.
Let's listen to a little bit of that duet between yourself and your father, Johnny Cash. September When It Comes.
There's a cross above the baby's bed, a savior in her dreams. she was not delivered then, and the baby became me. There's a light inside a darkened room, a footstep on the stair, a door that I forever close to leave those memories there. So when the shadows lengthen into an evening sun, well, first there's summer, then I'll let you in September when it comes.
I plan to crawl outside these walls, close my eyes and see, and fall into the heart and arms of those who wait for me. I cannot move a mountain now, I can no longer run, I cannot be who I was then, in a way I never was.
Watch the clouds go sailing, watch the clock and sun, oh, I watch myself depending on September. When it comes,
when the shadows lengthen and burn will fly me like an angel to a place where I can rest. When this begins,
I'll let you in
September,
when it comes.
I don't know about you, Roseanne, you're not in the same room as me. You're several thousand miles away in New York. But as I listened to those words that your father sings, and then, as we know, he was dead, you know, very soon afterwards. How is it for you, even at this remove, 20-something years later, to listen to that?
Well, I haven't listened to it in a long time, so I felt quite overwhelmed listening to it just then. And, you know, the words were very prescient. Well, you know, I was just, Sean, I was going about my day, packing up some boxes and things, and now you've taken me to a whole different place.
Sorry I did that to you. But all I can say to you is I felt, and, you know, I've never met you before. Well, I don't think we've spoken before. Even just listening to it, knowing that you were on the other side of the headphones, the microphones in New York, I felt kind of I was part of something very private and very special. Growing up with your father as the man that he was and the wonderful singer that we all know and so many people, particularly in this country, love. What did that do for you in your music career? It must have been both a blessing and a difficulty.
Yeah, it was. It was a difficulty, particularly when I was younger. It's not that different from any young person who wants to separate from their parents and find their own path and find who they are. You know, my dad did cast a very large shadow, and I was going into the same field as him. So it was difficult. And as I got older, and got some time under my belt and some success under my belt and got better as a songwriter and performer. It's gotten easier. But at some point I realized what a gift my own legacy is and how ungracious it would be not to embrace it fully.
Yeah, I can only imagine what a wonderful moment that must have been when you did find the courage to embrace it fully, because I'm sure there was courage involved in that. And I know, wasn't there at one point you were debating whether you would use the name Cash at all? You decided, obviously, I'm speaking to Roseanne Cash, not Roseanne somebody else or something else. When you decided to use that family name, your father was delighted.
Yeah, in the very early stages of my career, I thought, well, how am I going to get away from this comparison and this shadow? And I thought, well, I'll just use my grandmother's maiden name, which was Rivers. And I thought about it for a while and then decided against it. My dad knew that I was considering that, and he kind of breathed a sigh of relief when I said, I'm going to use my own name.
Yeah, yeah. And not only that, you found a much better way of getting away from it, if that's the right term. 16 Grammy nominations and 4 wins of your own kind of marks in the sand who you are, rather than, you know, the fact that you're that wonderful man's daughter in the midst of it all. You re-released your album, The Wheel, last year, which is a hugely important album in terms of yourself and your husband, John.
Yeah. What was interesting is we recorded that album in 1993. It's the first record John and I ever made together. We fell in love making the record, got married the next year and a half later. And I had a clause in my contract with Sony, who I was signed to at the time, that I would regain ownership of the master recording after 30 years. And that 30 years came due last year. And I felt so proud that I owned it again. I said, well, what should we do? Well, let's remaster it for modern sonic times and re-release it. And that's what we did.
And what a way to celebrate your 30th wedding anniversary, which must be in and around this time, is it?
We just celebrated 29, so yep, it's coming up next year.
Coming up next year. Well, listen, Roseanne, it has been an absolute privilege and pleasure to speak with you this evening. Sorry if I upset you later on. But
No. It's the good kind of upset, yeah. You know. Though even painful memories are sweet. So thank you, Sean.
Thank you very much, Roseanne, and looking forward to hearing and seeing your gig when you get here in the coming weeks and months. Thanks very much, Roseanne.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
That's Roseanne Cash, and Roseanne and John Leventhal, her husband, will perform at the National Concert Hall with Aoife O'Donovan on Thursday the 13th of June. Very special benefit concert to launch Musician Treatment Foundation in Ireland. You can find out full details on nch.ie. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. The winner of Dublin City Council's prestigious literary award was announced today by the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Dáithí Do Rochta, at a special ceremony at the International Literature Festival. The winner is Mircea Cărtărescu for his book Solenoid. And Mircea shares the €100,000 prize fund with the translator Sean Cotter. I'm delighted that both Mircea and Sean are with me in studio this evening. Congratulations, first of all, Mircea, on winning this Dublin Literary Award. You're a decorated writer before this. There's no doubt about that. The Fermenter Prize, the Thomas Mann Prize, many others among them. What does this particular prize mean to you?
First, I want to thank you very much for having me. What can I say? It's one of the biggest and most prestigious prizes that I have ever received in my life. I'm really very proud.
And Sean Cotter, when I say that name, mm-hmm. I automatically presume there's some kind of Irish connection. There may or may not be. You're the translator of the book, Sean. It's a wonderful aspect of the Dublin Literary Award that the translator gets a portion of that prize money.
It's wonderful for that recognition to be there, right? The translators in other cases might suffer from the lack of recognition, but... And it's good to be here and to be alongside my friend.
I wondered about that relationship. What is the nature of the relationship between yourself and Mircea? You have worked on his books previous to this, I think.
Yes, I translated the first volume of the Blinding Trilogy about 10 years ago. And obviously I knew about Mircea and I knew about his work, and he's the best known writer in Romania right now. But we got to know each other by working on these books together. And now I'm happy and proud to say that he's a friend.
For you, Mircea, what do you want from your translator? What do you expect to see and read in another language, in the English language version of the book?
In my opinion, Sean is the perfect translator for me. We know each other for a long time. We are a team, actually. We communicate all the time during the process of translation, and we share our experience, our difficulties, some passages that do not go too well. I'm happy to have him.
But do you go anywhere near him when you're writing the book in Romanian? Would you speak to him at any point along that stage of the process?
Yes, of course. Even during writing my books, I always think of my translators, not only of Sean. I work with about 15 translators for all the important languages in the world. They are my friends. We also are a sort of a gang, a sort of a team around my books. And not only that, we work a lot together, but we have a lot of fun together. Mm.
So where were you? At what point did Solenoid come across your radar, Sean?
After Blinding, I guess, Mircea is right, this group of translators, we're all in contact, usually over Facebook, if not over email. And so we have this, we all know what the other person's doing. And so eventually, it was a little bit after Blinding, we were all together in Iași, and we were all having a beer in some place in a basement pub. And Mircea said, the funny thing is that there's a version of this where we should be talking about the difficulties, you know, and we're all together, and instead we were just complaining about how hard the books are to translate. And Mircea was taking it all very well, and then he said, "By the way, I have to tell you something. I'm working on a new book. It's also going to be hard."
Not only is it going to be hard to translate, it's going to be hard to give us the world of this book. It is a very confused and labyrinthine world in many, many ways. In other ways, Mircea, it is the simple story of a young boy who becomes a writer. There's one element of the book which we might talk about specifically, and you can give us a sense of the plot per se through this. The young writer who goes to a workshop, he has a very bad experience at the workshop. There are echoes of this in your own life.
Thank you for having read my book, as far as I see. It's a sort of, as the Germans say, a Bildungsroman. So the story of making a personality, in a way. You are right. When I was quite young, I was 10, if I remember well, I had the huge chance of having a library in the neighborhood. And I went there, and from that day, when I was about 10, till I was 15 maybe, I had read all the books in that library. It was small, there were only four walls full of books, but I read everything. And I think I owe everything I am now to those years of self-education, self-formation, and so on. I was reading Dante Alighieri, Shakespeare, Joyce even, Virginia Woolf, Faulkner, and so on. So those books were very, very much and very well translated by that time in my language. Mm. And it was a great luck for me, because they made who I am now.
And you were reading these books in that library at that age of 10 to the early teens, I think is what you said to me.
Well, I started with the lesser books, not directly with...
You didn't start with Dublin.
Joyce's Ulysses.
Yeah, Ulysses, right, okay.
With Finnegan's Wake.
You left that until you were 15.
But anyway, I started with the Moby Dick, for example.
All right.
Which is... suitable even for youngsters. Hmm.
When did you start into Kafka? Because Kafka is all over Solenoid, is all over this book.
Kafka is not only my hero, I would say he's my god. Kafka is the person, not only the writer, but the person who obsesses me all the time, because he was a pure writer, something that I always wanted to be. I wanted to be Kafka. I wanted to never think of my readers, but writing only for myself, only for the huge pleasure of writing in itself. I borrowed from him his parables, his fantastic parables, his philosophy, his metaphysics. He's trying to explain our condition, the human condition, in short and powerful stories.
And if I'll come to you on this one, Sean, as Mircea has described Kafka there, it does echo many of the things that are in this book. And I wondered, is that part of what makes them so difficult to translate? I was touching with Mircea on the, there is a kind of a simple Bildungsroman aspect, a life story of this young writer. Some parallels with Mircea's life, some others that diverge fundamentally from his life. Can you give me the essence of that aspect of the story and then how it becomes labyrinthine, mostly through buildings, I would argue?
Yeah, so there's the basic story of a person who was a school teacher who had literary aspirations, who had this terrible experience when he first showed his poetry to a crowd of other students and a respected critic, and now is writing a kind of an anti-novel, what he calls a history of his anomalies. And so we get this story of him working at the school and going back and forth to his residence, but we also get the story of all the strange things that happen at the school. Why it is that every time he turns a particular corner, there's a group of school children, always the same children, always getting the same medication, always on a sugar cube with a little dot of pink liquid. Why is it that when he can't find his classroom, and then when he goes, the classroom numbers change, they exhaust the Arabic numerals, exhaust the Roman numerals, and go into symbols that we don't even understand? Why is it that when we go across the street to the factory, where the students go to hang out and probably, you know, smoke or whatever they're doing, why does that turn out to be a mausoleum or a series of showcases of kind of biological extraordinary specimens? All these things. So we take the world that we have and follow out its natural possibilities into the unnatural.
And that following, brilliantly explained to us by Sean there, Mircea, in some ways, is it too simplistic to think of the places that those labyrinths, those labyrinthine buildings? How much of a dream world is this, or is it something more than that?
From my point of view, there is no distinction between realism and fantastic literature. They are both intertwined. I usually start from a very realistic background, but step by step, I love to turn everything into oniric, fantastic, satiric literature, all kinds of literature, and mainly metaphysical literature. I love to turn the most realistic and most vulgar, I would say, reality into bliss, into knowledge, into wisdom, and so on. My book has, in a way, all the layers, starting from the inferno to the paradise, starting from the most basic things and most disgusting sometimes things, till revelation. So I think I could define Solenoid as a total novel, a sphere that encompasses everything that I saw, I got to know, I understood from living.
May I ask you one final question? Because I mentioned Ceausescu's Romania, which is the Romania that you grew up in, where you read those books in that library, I'm guessing, as well. How has that regime informed your writing? I mean, these labyrinthine buildings have reflections in, I suppose, the big palace, the Grand Palace in Bucharest. There are aspects of that have parallels here. But how did growing up in Ceausescu's Romania affect what you write now today?
It's a complex question, but I would say now that the experience of being in a dictatorship, of living in a dictatorship, which was actually a sort of a prison, because you couldn't leave your country, for example. You didn't even have a passport. I was 43 when I could travel abroad for the first time. Besides suffering from hunger, suffering from cold, suffering from fear, the fear of the secret police, our experiences that, in my opinion, make you stronger, make you better, make you understand better the human condition, because the conditions in a dictatorship are extreme. So living there, you get to know yourself better, to know how it is to live in a total jeopardy. And this wasn't bad for me. It's a paradox. But now I think a part of what I am and a part of my stubbornness to go on writing and to do it up to the end with no limits, I owed it to that terrible period of my life in the Ceausescu's regime.
Well, a wonderful paradox for you, a wonderful delight for us as readers that you managed to get out of that.
Thank
and give
you
us
so
the
much.
Books that you've given us. Mircea Cărtărescu, congratulations once again on winning the Dublin Literary Award for the novel Solenoid.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. And Sean Cotter, translator, thank you for being with us too. Sorry, Mircea, did you want to say something just before we finish?
Yes, I would like to say again how proud I am for this prize.
Well, we're delighted for you. Congratulations. Mircea Cărtărescu there, as I say, and his translator, Sean Cotter. The book is called Solenoid and it is published by Deep Vellum Publishing from Dallas in Texas. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. The programme was researched by Paula Shields, Leah Murphy and Barbara Rose Sanwell. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound and the programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will be back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.